Thank you, and thank you for being here. I do love to start with inviting all of us to just look at each other. If you can turn your camera on, even for a few minutes, you may see people who you know, who you don't know, but it's really sweet to see each other's faces, to create all of this community together. And I do understand if you need to turn the video off, might be have to do with your internet bandwidth or you're doing something else, but if you just look around, nobody knows who's looking at whom when, which is especially sweet because you can just look and take in each other's faces, bright smiles, connect with each other. So I especially love this time where we actually see each other. And if you feel like it, you can chat in geographically where you are calling in from. I am calling in from the unceded land of the Wiat, which is Arcata, California, 300 miles north of San Francisco on the Redwoods. But go ahead and type it in if you feel like it. And you don't have to if you don't want to. But it is fun to get a sense of our Sangha geographically. Okay, so how our morning will go is that we'll begin shortly with an arriving meditation, which is my very favorite way to enter into any practice time. It's a beautiful transition from whatever we've each been doing in settling into this time of practice. And then I'll offer some Dharma thoughts, and then we'll have a longer meditation. Well, maybe we'll have a break. We'll see how it's all going. For a little more of a Dharma talk, but within all of that, plenty of time to ask questions and to talk with each other. Okay, so let's drop into an arriving meditation. I invite you to find a posture that is right for you, something that works in your body. Whether you're sitting or standing or reclining, just noticing the posture of the body. Dropping the shoulders a bit. Softening the belly. Loosening the jaw. Welcoming yourself. And if this is your first time at Spirit Rock, a really big welcome to you. If you haven't been here for a long time, a big welcome back. And always a welcome to everyone who comes week by week. Here we are together. From this arriving in the body, a little bit of settling. You might notice the breathing coming and going. You can close your eyes if you like, or keep them open with a soft downward gaze. Arriving, settling, landing. And whatever you've been doing before coming to Sangha today, letting that settle out. If your mind is still on whatever you've been doing or whatever's happening after Sangha, See if you can just let that go off to the side, to really invite yourself to be fully present right here. And it may have taken a lot for you to get here today. Offering yourself a bow of appreciation and recognition for your efforts to come to practice. You might notice any energies moving around the body, comfortable, uncomfortable, pleasant, unpleasant, somewhere in the middle. Maybe noticing a sense of temperature. Could be cold hands, warm feet, maybe even not noticing. Just coming into some presence with what is happening on the inside for you. And coming into an awareness that's beyond the inside. What is around you? Maybe noticing sound. Just the space around you, sensing into that. This is a way to cultivate both internal and external awareness. This is called Presence from Melissa Shaw Smith. The year has rocked this world to its roots. What if for one day each being put down their burdens, their words of hate, their inhumanity, and breathed in the presence, stopped fighting for history, for fears, hopes, dreams, and stood facing the morning sun, letting the warmth of the moment and the next, accumulate like dust at their feet, listened instead of spoke, acknowledged truth, embraced silence. What if for one day each being acknowledged the fear and let it go? Suspended beliefs opened their arms, drew strength through earth, grass, rock, sand. Found the sparrows singing from a lone bush, the small heart-shaped cloud. Felt the currents of air wash over them, mingle with the breath, and let the seams unravel, borders blend, walls dissolve, and be one. Good morning again, everybody. So it is a pleasure to be here. It's been about a month, I think, maybe a little more. So what I've been doing, I want to share this with you a little bit. Each year I spend time on a river in a canyon somewhere, leading meditation river rafting retreats. And I've just returned from the San Juan River, which is southeastern Utah in the Four Corners area. Anybody been there? Anybody been to Four Corners? So you know a little bit about it. It's an amazing place of rock and water and erosion and sky and weather, and it's very, very elemental. And where we were on the San Juan River, one side of the river was BLM land, Bureau of Land Management, and the other side of the river, for the week that we were there, is all Navajo land. It's the Navajo Reservation. And so we're basically gifted with the permission to be able to explore in these lands on river left. And BLM is BLM, and you can be on BLM land. But what was so amazing there is how ancient it is. It's so old. The indigenous cultures that are there go so far back, we don't really even know. And it's such a land of life. And sometimes we think of the desert as no life in the desert, but it's actually an incredibly rich environment. And what happens with erosion and those weathering elements and the animals and the plants that come alive with just a little bit of water. And because it's been such a wet winter, the river was fast. It was really flowing, and the wildflowers were everywhere. Yellow, pink, fuchsia, red, orange, so much greenery. There was so much life. And not only was the river really alive and the plants and the flowers, but for the first time, I saw wild donkeys and wild horses, which was also really amazing to watch at a distance. Well, maybe you've seen commercials of wild horses, right? And it's a thunderous run, and their tails and their manes are flying. Well, they were. It was so beautiful to watch these horses fly up these mesas, really. And then there were the donkeys. The donkeys didn't move like that. They really hung out together. But because it was a river rafting meditation retreat, there were times where we'd be sitting in meditation and all of a sudden, I won't do the noise for you, the donkeys start going and going and going. And there's just no way not to laugh. You know, there's just, you just have to just take in where you are and enjoy it. And the donkeys had something to say to us. But the other thing that there are, I don't even know how much, it's everywhere, are petroglyphs and pictographs. And the history of people who have been there for thousands and thousands of years, recording who they were and what they were doing. And, you know, there are people who study petroglyphs and pictographs who really understand what this record is. And then there were the dwellings, amazing dwellings, like, you know, to look up at a canyon wall, and it was unimaginable how people got up there and created these dwellings way high up. And part of it is that the river used to be a lot higher, and so they weren't climbing up as high, but there were steps that are carved into the canyon walls, or they had vines or ropes. There were, you know, people are really smart and very ingenious. And so what happens for me when I'm in those settings is I feel so small, you know, so small in response or in the presence of that kind of history and that kind of, you know, it is. It's the history of who has been here for millennia. And then to start thinking about it in a current cultural context, the colonization that has happened and what has happened to these indigenous cultures, so much that we don't know. And we are such a blip on this scale of deep time, maybe not even a blip, you know, half a blip. But that's how it makes me feel when I'm there, is such a guest. And so when we acknowledge the land in whatever sanghas, whatever groups that we may participate in, and we recognize those who have come before us and before us and before. I was thinking about it. There are some of these petroglyphs that are dated to about 5,000 years. And I was trying to figure out, you know, we hear about seventh generation, that we go back seven generations to see what has happened that has informed our lives from seven generations ago, and to be so careful and aware of what we do now, so seven generations ahead of us will live with as much health as possible. But 5,000 years, you know how many generations that is? That's 250 generations. Sort of an unimaginable amount of time it probably goes beyond that. But these petroglyphs, and the difference between a petroglyph and a pictograph, a petroglyph is when a picture is carved into stone or tapped, or different tools that were used for that. Not to mention all the pottery shards that we came across. That's a different thing. And a pictograph is used with dye. It's more of a painting, but nonetheless, they survive. And you can see that some are in better shape than others, and we don't know exactly what they mean, of course. But it's an extraordinary experience to feel both so small and also so connected that I was there, imagining what these people were doing, and that they survived. And, you know, sometimes we can arrogantly have the thought, well, how did these people know how to do that? Well, humans are really smart. You know, and what's to say that we've gotten smarter in our creativity? Maybe we haven't a bit. We just use different kinds of tools. So it's an amazing experience and gift to be able to, in that way, feel like I was going back in time to have a little bit of a glimpse, and then bring this practice of awareness and compassion and wisdom into being part of this huge, long lineage of being human. And the horses and the donkeys were really great. that was just really, really beautiful. And then, of course, I was in a little bit of a fantasy, I'll say, about the lives of these donkeys and the lives of these horses. And our trip leader, one of the river guides, is a Navajo man, and was telling us more and more about where we were. And it turns out that there's a lot of competition for the grazing land. And you might know this. I mean, the whole Colorado River Plateau is in a lot of turmoil because there's so much grazing that is happening from livestock, but also wild donkeys. And the donkeys, more than the horses, I'm led to understand, are really taking over this grazing area. And it's a problem for people who are raising their own food. So periodically, there are donkey roundups. Wild donkeys get rounded up and taken to Mexico. And I said, I almost didn't want to ask, but I did. I said, so what happens to the donkeys when they go to Mexico? And one person said, well, you know, donkeys are used for all kinds of work in Mexico. And then I asked somebody else, what's happening with the roundup of the donkeys? And what's happening with the roundup of the donkeys is that they are slaughtered. And it really broke my heart. And then the other view of this is how do we balance out the needs of all beings? And it's a very difficult conversation, because certainly people, farmers, ranchers, or little families who might grow a couple of animals and then they eat them all year long, that's what they do. So I'm sharing this all with you because it is a way of experiencing life from a different perspective. Certainly got me out of my regular everyday life here in Humboldt County, but this is why I do it, because I do love being part of the wilderness and the elements and learning more about who's there and what's there and what's happening, and being willing to have a broken heart, you know, being willing to face, oh, this is the truth of life, of how this works. So in the context of these retreats, I like to bring in a framework of practice that I'm going to bring into us now, that I'll be here next week also, so we'll probably extend this over this week and next week, because I have so much I want to share, so much I want to say, and so I'm just going to slow it down a little bit. In one of Pema Chodron's books, she says that there are just three instructions that we need for living a life. One is be fully present. The second, feel your heart. And the third, engage the next moment without an agenda. And the last one always sort of makes me laugh. I mean, because I can definitely learn to cultivate being fully present, which we're doing. I love the heart practices. You know, that is actually a place that I start from, are these heart practices. But to engage the next moment without an agenda, who doesn't have an agenda, right? And or the list or the to-do list or the ideas of things should or shouldn't be this way or that way. And this practice of deeply understanding equanimity, which we can not only define as balance, but perspective, capacity, within the truth of impermanence, and asking us to stay open to let's see what happens next. It's hard. It's really hard. That's also the truth of it, the dukkha of it. Nobody said that this was easy. The not quite rightness are, I don't really know how to relate to how do I not have an agenda? Because if I don't have an agenda, and I don't just mean the to-do list, I mean that the fixed views of how things should or shouldn't be, if I let go of that, how do I experience frames of reference? Do I lose control? What am I in control of? Not much, actually, right? Pretty much the only thing is how I respond to whatever is happening in my life. So I want to start here today with the third of these instructions on engage the next moment without an agenda. Carlita, will you please put this picture up for me, us? Okay, so this might be familiar to some of you. And when you look at this, just notice what you notice. This is a photograph that is called the pale blue dot. Anybody familiar with it? See if you, maybe some people. Okay, so if you look in the center, just to the right of center, can you see what looks like a white dot? Can you point it out, Carlita? Thank you. That's us. That's the Earth. And there we are in the universe. And here's a piece from Carl Sagan from 1994 that he wrote called The Pale Blue Dot. Carl Sagan, the brilliant astronomer. And this is on perspective and interconnection and the big picture. This excerpt from Sagan's book, Pale Blue Dot, was inspired by an image taken at his suggestion by Voyager 1 on February 14, 1990. As the spacecraft left our planetary neighborhood for the fringes of the solar system, engineers turned it around for one last look at its home planet. Voyager 1 was about 6.4 billion, That's 4 billion kilometers, 4 billion miles away, and approximately 32 degrees above the ecliptic plane when it captured this portrait of our world. Caught in the center of scattered light rays as a result of taking the pictures so close to the sun, the Earth appears as a tiny point of light, a crescent only 0.12 pixel in size. Look again at that dot. That's here. That's home. That's us. On it, everyone you love, everyone you know, everyone you ever heard of, every human being who ever was, lived out their lives. The aggregate of our joy and suffering, thousands of confident religions, ideologies, and economic doctrines, every hunter and forager, every hero and coward, every creator and destroyer of civilization, every king and peasant, every young couple in love, every mother and father, hopeful child, inventor and explorer, every teacher of morals, every corrupt politician, every superstar, every supreme leader, every saint and sinner in the history of our species lived there on a mote of dust suspended in a sunbeam. The Earth is a very small stage in a vast cosmic arena. Think of the rivers of blood spilled by all those generals and emperors so that in glory and in triumph, they could become the momentary masters of a fraction of a dot. Think of the endless cruelties visited by the inhabitants of one corner of this pixel on the scarcely distinguishable inhabitants of some other corner, how frequent their misunderstandings, how eager they are to kill one another, how fervent their hatreds. Our posturings, our imagined self-importance, the delusion that we have some privileged position in the universe are challenged by this point of pale light. Our planet is a lonely speck in the great enveloping cosmic dark. In our obscurity, in all this vastness, there's no hint that help will come from elsewhere to save us from ourselves. The Earth is the only world known so far to harbor life. There is nowhere else, at least in the near future, to which our species could migrate. Visit, yes. Settle, not yet. Like it or not, for the moment, the Earth is where we make our stand. It's been said that astronomy is a humbling and character-building experience. There's perhaps no better demonstration of the folly of human conceits than this distant image of our tiny world. To me, said Sagan, it underscores our responsibility to deal more kindly with one another and to preserve and cherish the pale blue dot, the only home we've ever known. Have you heard that before? It's really something, isn't it? When you look at that picture and that we are on a mote of dust suspended in a sunbeam, it puts things in perspective, doesn't it? This is a practice of perspective. And out of this, these basic fundamental teachings make so much sense that there is a Nietzsche, impermanence. Everything is in the process of change. Always. The truth of dukkha, the truth of not quite rightness. That's how I think of dukkha, friction. We call it suffering, but it's this sense of not quite rightness. Anatta, not self, the delusion, the illusion that we're separate. You see a picture like that, and we're just a mote of dust out there in the cosmos. But my experience that I share with you about being in this land that is so rich and so old and seeing the connections throughout history, that even though we're on this mote of dust, we still have such responsibility, such deep responsibility to behave well, right? To really train ourselves so we understand that greed and hatred and unconsciousness, confusion, ignorance, create suffering everywhere. And that generosity and love and wisdom, non-greed, clarity of mind, create happiness. And this is logical. This is actually what brought me into this practice and keeps me here, because it's logical. In the third Zen patriarch, in the verses of the faith mind, Sang Tsan said, "The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. When love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. Make the smallest distinction, however, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. If you wish to see the truth, then hold no opinions for or against anything. To set up what you like against what you don't like is the disease of the mind. When the deep meaning of things is not understood, the mind's essential peace is disturbed to no avail." And then he goes on to say, do not search for the truth. Even though he just said, if you wish to see the truth, but do not search for the truth. Only cease to cherish opinions. To live in this realization is to be without anxiety about non-perfection. This teaching is very long. This is just an excerpt from it. But what it's pointing to is, can we hold a wide perspective? Can we see that the things, the ways that we get caught, the Four Noble Truths, that they're true, the way we get caught in our opinions, our fixed views, the shoulds and the shouldn'ts, begin to get in the way of everything. And that's not to say that having a moral center isn't right. It is. To have wholesome view, wholesome intent, is very different than wishing ill will, right? When the forces of greed take over. So this is very difficult. So one of the hardest things to do is to uproot greed and ill will and understand when the mind is confused and how that informs our actions. It's a deep, deep allowing. And it's painful. It's painful. Okay, I'm going to pause there because we need to get to our meditation. But are there any questions from anything I've said so far? All right, we'll keep going on the other side. And I want you to know that we'll also have time to talk with each other about meditation after the meditation too. So, wide perspective, even holding your meditation practice with some space. Maybe you've heard the expression to rest in awareness. I'll just say this one more thing before we move into the meditation. There are teachings, I imagine, I know for me what is true. There are many teachings that I've heard over and over again over the years that just go right by. And I just think, oh yeah, I've heard that. But they don't land. I really don't get it. And then there are the teachings that do, that I really understand, that I gravitate towards, that inform my practice. And I wonder for you also, are there those sorts of phrases, Dharma phrases that you might hear that they just go by, they're just part of the mix. So one of those phrases for me was rest in awareness. And sometime, I don't know when it was, but at some point, I heard it in a deeper, clearer, resonant way that in meditation, I didn't have to be so busy doing, but I could actually settle back and feel that sense of a bigger awareness, rest there. Just the awareness of breathing, the awareness of sitting, the awareness of sound, whatever it is, the elements, rest there. Don't do anything about it. Just rest there. Relax. And that was a pivotal instruction when I finally got it. So I'll try to offer a little bit of guidance about resting and relaxing today. All right. Bring yourself, invite yourself into a posture that works well for you. whether you're sitting or standing or reclining. Just know the posture, sensing the places the body is touching whatever it's connected to, the furniture, the floor, and also the places the body is connected to itself. Are the hands touching the body? The insides of the upper arms softly touching the sides of the torso? The tongue in the mouth, the lips? If your eyes are closed, noticing the touch of the eyelids. And in this way, there's a certain steadiness that can arise, a groundedness in this body, right here at this time. And aware of the breathing, the coming and going of this breath. And if it feels accessible for you, let yourself be very close to the experience of this in-breath, the beginning, middle, and end of the in-breath. And likewise, close to the experience of the out-breath, the beginning, middle, and end of the out-breath. Following the breath cycle through, all the way from the beginning, through the middle, to the end. You might notice the slight pause between breaths. You might notice there's a place in the body where you feel your breath the most. And there might not be a place in your body where you sense the breathing, but you know you're breathing. And that's just right also. Sit and know you're sitting. Breathe and know you're breathing. Resting and reconnecting with being alive right here at this time. Relaxing. Releasing. Frank Ostasevsky says that awareness itself is the ultimate resting place. So wherever that place is that works for you to rest your awareness, do that, but give it space. Not holding tightly, resting in a relaxed, attentive way, and we'll sit quietly. And as we continue to sit quietly, if you notice any tightening, sometimes it happens quite without the noticing. All of a sudden the jaw is tight, all of a sudden the shoulders rise. Soften wherever it can be softened. And maybe use the word rest. Simply rest. Come back to that. noticing any amount of space that is happening on the inside. Ease, maybe a little calm from resting right here in the awareness of being alive, the awareness of touch, the awareness of breath, the awareness of being here, quiet, together. Simply notice. As you continue, and we continue together to cultivate this quality of spacious awareness, restful, attentive awareness, not fixing, not striving, not judging, this deep allowing of being right here, you may notice some dukkha arising. Some quality of not quite right, some friction. Can you let that just be as it is, knowing it will change? Just being here. continuing to stay with the meditation. Just let these words wash over you, take them in as you want. This is from Norman Fisher. Dukkha is not a mistake. It's not a correctable situation. It's human consciousness. Dukkha is every moment, every experience of our lives, not just the things that obviously seem to be dukkha, like pain, suffering, and loss. Pain, suffering, and loss are built into every moment of consciousness, even if they don't appear on the surface to be pain, suffering, and loss. They're there. The great and beautiful secret of meditation practice is this. You can experience dukkha with equanimity. Isn't equanimity the secret of happiness? If you tried to eliminate dukkha, it would be like trying to eliminate life. But if you receive dukkha with equanimity, then in a way, it's no longer dukkha. Impermanence could be the most devastating fact of life, and often it is. But impermanence could also be incredibly beautiful if you receive it with equanimity. It could be peace itself. Dukkha is this basic fact of life. So for the next few minutes, widening out the awareness again to include the full range of your experience of being alive in this moment, engaging this next moment without shoulds or shouldn'ts, just being here. And then drawing the awareness into the heart space, this heart center. Maybe you notice it as the center of the chest or the upper back. If you'd like to place your hand gently on the chest, maybe move it around a little bit as a way to connect with the warmth of your own body, touching itself, the goodness that's inside of you, this warmth. And offering yourself any kind of metta, loving kindness, wishes that work for you. It can be very simple, they can be more complex, whatever works. It could be as simple as, may I feel well. May I be at ease. And then expanding that circle beyond yourself to anybody who comes to mind. Letting your heart beam that kind of goodwill to them. Maybe offering the same phrases, your own or these. May you be well. May you be at ease. Just starting to engage the heart. And as we make more space inside of ourselves to experience our own humanity, there's more space for others, space beyond ourselves and others, much wider space. From Rumi, moonlight floods the whole sky from horizon to horizon. How much it can fill your room depends on its windows. Moonlight floods the whole sky from horizon to horizon. How much it can fill your room depends on its windows. Oh, I'm glad you're here. I'm glad that we are all here. So let's talk about this thing about dukkha, because I think this is really interesting, and I'd like to tease it apart with you. So in talking about engage the next moment without an agenda, and you might immediately feel like, oh yeah, right, how am I going to do that? How we do that, and we'll talk more about it, is to be fully present, is to feel the heart, is to, oftentimes in our practice, is a phrase that says, trust the unfolding. In order to trust the unfolding, we need some foundational practices as well. The understanding of the Four Noble Truths, that life is difficult for everyone, and there's a way to manage that. The understanding that equanimity is possible, having a wider perspective, to be able to have enough practices in the tool belt to navigate both the extremes of joy and sorrow, the middle ground of joy and sorrow. And going back to this very poignant and maybe paradoxical teaching from the Third Zen Patriarch that says the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. Well, I have preferences. I bet you have preferences. Right? I mean, we got to be real with this. This is what I meant at the beginning when I said, what I really want to study and be engaged in this practice is, why does this matter and how does it actually work? So the great way, meaning our practice, is not difficult for those who have no preferences. Okay, so it is difficult then, right? It can be a challenge, but it's also inviting and it's logical, and maybe it doesn't feel difficult, that there's a way to manage the preferences, to see, are they wholesome or unwholesome preferences? When are shades of greed and ill will strong in the mind heart that it takes us into a difficult direction? Or are we able to have a relationship with the naturally occurring shades of greed and ill will and delusion that we can say, oh yeah, that's what's happening, and we're not hijacked by it? Does that make sense to you? Because there's a real difference between letting ourselves be human and say, well, these things are going to arise, but the pivot point, the chink in it, is what is our relationship to it? Am I caught? Am I hijacked? There's a difference between, like, we can think about that as far as thoughts in the mind, being aware of thought versus being lost in thought versus being hijacked by thought. And this is something that we can work very directly with in the meditation, especially when we cultivate and invite a more restful, open space in meditation. We're more likely to see the arising of different kinds of thoughts, different kinds of emotional heart energies. So in that way, we can have preferences, but they don't lead us around by the nose, right? I mean, that's really what that is. We're not hijacked. And then it goes on to say, when love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. Well, a natural response to that might be, I don't want love to be absent. That's crazy. But I think, again, we're talking about not being caught in any particular state, being supported by love, being supported by goodness, and understanding that it has its different cycles and its different shades. If you wish to see the truth, then hold no opinions against anything. Again, this is this piece of a wide, spacious awareness that's rooted in wisdom, which is actually one of the definitions that Nyanaponika Thera, a German-born monk, he defines equanimity as the perfect, unshakable spaciousness of mind rooted in insight. What a tall order! What an aspirational state of mind. The perfect, unshakable spaciousness of mind rooted in insight. Maybe we get glimpses periodically, but this is what we're training in, is in this relaxed awareness. Out of the relaxation, and Sylvia taught on this a couple of weeks ago when she was teaching on making space and how can we use the breath to make more space to first calm this whole being so wisdom can arise, so insight can arise. And that's what we're doing in Vipassana. And sometimes we think about it as shamatha Vipassana. Shamatha meaning this peaceful abiding, this calming that we do that happens when we first settle in, holding the awareness, breath, 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 or sensation, sensation, sensation. That has a way of stabilizing. And out of that stabilizing, there's some calm, some stillness that can often happen. And oftentimes, when the mind is not constricted, that's when the insights arise, right? Do you have that experience sometimes, when things are more spacious, that's when we go, oh yeah, I got that idea, or oh, now I understand what's happening. And that's that openness that can happen. But when we hold opinions for or against anything, it keeps us in a box. So noticing what are the fixed views, what are the wholesome views, what are the views that become a moral compass? We need that. But how do we live our lives within all of that? And we're not going to always get it right. And what I love about this faith verses is this line that says, to live in this realization is to be without anxiety about non-perfection. Isn't that a great line? To be without anxiety about non-perfection. Because we live in this culture that pushes this, what I think is a false, ridiculous notion that perfect even exists. That is cultural construct. So what we're talking about to live in this realization, I think, is the truth of dukkha. Is the truth of dukkha. And what happens with fixed views when we get caught, when the mind shuts down. And so let me read this to you again. I really do want to hear what your thoughts are on this. This piece about dukkha, not quite rightness, or if you want to think about imperative in the mind that things be other, that is a brilliant definition from Sylvia around what is suffering. Dukkha is not a mistake. It's not a correctable situation. Now, right there, it's not a mistake and it's not correctable. Doesn't that let us off the hook to say this is just one of the most natural manifestations of being human? It's human consciousness itself, says Norman. Dukkha is every moment, every experience of our lives, not just the things that obviously seem to be dukkha, like pain and suffering and loss. Pain, suffering, and loss are built into every moment of consciousness, even if they don't appear on the surface to be pain, suffering, and loss. That takes some unpacking. And we could talk about that. It's built in pain, suffering, and loss. This is the truth of impermanence. This is the truth of this perpetual sense of not quite rightness, of constantly acclimating and adjusting to our circumstances. I'm too cold, I'm too hot, I'm thirsty, I'm hungry. Those are all permutations of dukkha light, right? That's just dukkha light. But we're always adjusting continually. And if you just notice that in your own body throughout the day, how many times do you put a sweater on, take a sweater off, cross your legs, uncross your legs, whatever it is, scratch an itch. I mean, this is just what's happening constantly. So it's built in to this wiring, even if they don't appear on the surface to be pain, suffering, or loss. And then he goes on to say, and I love this, the great and beautiful secret of meditation practice is this. Now, you know, when anybody says the great and beautiful secret to anything is this, doesn't that wake you up? Like, okay, you're going to tell me the answer to everything. You can experience dukkha with equanimity. Now, when I read that, I relaxed. Oh, I can have a wide, spacious mind that is open, that expands my perspective. I can cultivate balance, but I can also experience dukkha. I can experience that I just learned that the donkeys are going to get shipped out to Mexico, and I can feel the pain of that, and I can also feel the beauty and the joy of being out in that desert and watching them. That equanimity with the dukkha. Isn't equanimity the secret of happiness, Norman says? You know, find out for yourself, right? This is the teaching of the Buddha. Don't take my word for it. Find out for yourself. Is equanimity the secret of happiness? If you tried to eliminate dukkha, it would be like trying to eliminate life. Like, this is just true. But if you can receive dukkha with equanimity, then in a way, it's no longer dukkha. Isn't that a good paradox? If we can say, okay, this can be here. I can include and integrate difficulty that I wish wasn't there, but it's just true, and it is. It's no longer dukkha. It's just something that's true. It's just something that's here. Impermanence could be the most devastating fact of life, and often it is. And I would guess that all of us here have experienced loss and change in a way that broke our hearts. If you haven't, just wait. This is part of it. But impermanence could also be incredibly beautiful if you receive it with equanimity. And you know, there's sometimes I hear myself say, of course, which is a way of receiving dukkha with equanimity. Of course this is happening. It's the way of living a life. And Norman says, this could be peace itself. Dukkha, this basic fact of life received with equanimity, could be peace itself. So what do you think of this? Anybody at all? Greg, welcome.
Oh, thank you, Heidi. And I really appreciated that reading. Perhaps maybe you can in the chat put where that came from again so I could go back and reflect on it or if that's available. But anyway, regardless, beginning of the reading when, in fact, you emphasized the point that he made that dukkha is not correctable, that it's not a mistake. I got kind of an impact on me, kind of a new insight. And that's very powerful, that idea. Because I realize that a lot of the dukkha that I experience is that I don't think things should be the way they are, that they should be correctable. And as you were saying, this, you know, the concept of that is not quite enough. It's something that I have to experience, that that's what I'm doing. I'm trying to correct things, and it's creating dukkha, but that's okay. That, I mean,
can it be okay?
Yeah,
can it be okay? Right. So, you know, we could take this throughout so many of these teachings where we get reminded that we're not exempt. We are just not exempt. We're not exempt from dukkha. We're not exempt from loss. We're not exempt from aging and illness and death and being separated from everything and everyone that we love. We're also not exempt from joy. We are also not exempt from happiness and love. And that can feel a little harder, but we can be very busy trying to fix what we think is wrong. And that's dukkha. Now, obviously, there are some things that we do act on. So it's not to say that we don't use our wisdom and just let things go to pot when we can really help support whatever it is. But it's the added contention that is the dukkha. Like, you can say, Greg, oh yeah, this is something that I want to see different because, and you know why you're doing what you're doing. But this is where we get into the difference between attachment and commitment. Like, you can commit to acting for the good for whatever it is. But if you can only be happy if it turns out exactly the way you want it to turn out, that's dukkha. You follow me? The difference between the attachment and the commitment. Like, you know, you can have such wholesome intent, and you do that work. I do this work. And I know that there are potholes. There are potholes, and we're going to climb out of them, and we're going to keep doing good work. And it isn't easy.
Yeah.
That quote, it came out of Norman Fisher's book. I can't remember the title of it. I will try to find it. I'll try to find it and put it in the chat, but I'll have to pause a minute to do that before we end at some point.
No problem. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. I do love your point, though. I think this is a really, that dukkha is not a mistake. It's not a correctable situation. It's human consciousness. We are not exempt. But we have the ability to shift and cultivate a different relationship to it. I heard somebody the other day say something about, there's actually no bad and no good. Nothing is bad and nothing is good. And I think what this person was pointing to was, is it's what we project our values onto whatever it is. And obviously we know that there is harm. We know there's definitely harm that is done, and harm is not good. It's not for the overall well-being of an individual or a group. But if you really take it apart, the existence of this or that is simply the existence of this or that. And it's what we think of this or that that puts it on the spectrum of good, bad, comfortable, uncomfortable. Do you get what I mean?
Oh, yeah. I was recently experiencing something. I don't want to take up too much time, but I recently went through a sinus surgery, and I'm in recovery now from that. And my, you know, surgeon, my doctor told me, you could experience a total loss of taste and smell, and there could be some side effects from this. And I knew that going in, and that's exactly what happened. But the knowledge of that happening didn't actually alleviate the anxiety I was going through when it happened. The knowledge that this could be temporary, my mind was actually telling me, what if this doesn't go away? You know, and what if this isn't temporary? And did I do something in my recovery that caused this to happen? Because I did smell for a couple of days and then I didn't. What did I do? But I can actually get attached to that make the anxiety increase if I decided to latch on to that. But I can actually feel that and experience that and let it be there without getting attached to it, and it dissipated. It really dissipated when I did that. Yeah, it just dissipated after I was able to let it
go. So I think that this is the point that difficulty happens, things happen. Let's not even call it difficulty. Stuff happens every moment of every day. And it's where we place it on our own value scale, good, bad, uncomfortable, comfortable, liking, disliking, that actually has the ripple effect of our relationship to it. It should or shouldn't be happening versus this might happen. It will be temporary. So this is a good example of something that is impermanent. We don't know how long it's going to take, but it is changing. And anybody who's ever gone through any kind of physical ailment, which I would guess every single person here has, you know that it takes time. There's a certain time element to healing, whatever it is. And we're often quite impatient with that because it shouldn't be this way, because I don't want to feel this, because this is uncomfortable. Or it's frightening. What if I never get it back? That kind of loss. So thanks for bringing that up, Greg. Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it. So I want to finish with this. It's an injunction towards goodness from Howard Zinn. You know, we started today talking about big picture. I started talking about what is it like out in the river and out in the canyons and that kind of being connected to so many thousands of years of history. And we talked about the pale blue dot, getting that. So that we started with pale blue dot, and then we're coming in and we're touching on dukkha and what it means to just live this life. And next week we'll talk more about how specifically through being cultivating heart practices and being fully present in the body. But this is what Howard Zinn says. To be hopeful in bad times is based on the fact that human history is a history not only of cruelty, but also of compassion, sacrifice, courage, and kindness. What we choose to emphasize in this complex history will determine our lives. If we see only the worst, it destroys our capacity to do something. If we remember those times and places, and there are so many, where people have behaved magnificently, this gives us the energy to act, and at least the possibility of sending this spinning top of a world in a different direction. And if we do act, in however small a way, we don't have to wait for some grand utopian future. The future is an infinite succession of presence. And to live now as we think human beings should live, in defiance of all that is bad around us, is itself a marvelous victory. We can choose. And this is what our practice teaches us and supports us to do. To trust your goodness, to trust in the goodness of others. To be hopeful. Right? And this is when the Buddha said in his penultimate teaching, move into the future with confidence, strive on with diligence. So I wish you all a beautiful week. We'll continue on this topic next week. I hope you can come back. May all beings be peaceful and happy and come to the end of suffering. And this includes each one of us. Hi, everybody. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.